Welcome. I'm Doris Wise Montrose, President of Children of Jewish Holocaust Survivors. Thank you for joining us tonight. Some may be wondering what capitalism has to do with anti-Semitism. Hitler explained that for us. We are socialists. We are enemies of today's capitalist economic system for the exploitation of the economically weak, with its unfair salaries, with its unseemly evaluation of a human being according to wealth and property instead of responsibility and performance. And we are determined to destroy this system under all conditions. Hitler told a party leader in 1934, "The economic system of our day is the creation of the Jews." This continues today, as Joe Carter writes in his short post, "Anti-Capitalism and Anti-Semitism." I'm not agreeing with the claim that Occupy Wall Street is somehow shot through with anti-Semitism. The movement seems incapable of rallying around any idea, much less one as nefarious as anti-Semitism, but let's not be naive. Wherever you find a group that is railing against capitalism, it won't be long before you attract types who want to blame Jews. Tyler Cowen from Socialist Roots of Modern Anti-Semitism. Capitalism and the market economy encourage racial, ethnic, and religious tolerance while supporting a plurality of diverse lifestyles and customs. Heavily regulated or socialist economies, in contrast, tend to breed intolerance and ethnic persecution. We are privileged tonight to have Yaron Brook, Executive Director of the Ayn Rand Institute, who has graciously agreed to discuss this issue in conjunction with his newest book, Free Market Revolution, How Ayn Rand Ideas Can End Big Government. As you will recall, Hitler was also a big fan of big government. Of the many glowing reviews this book has received, retired chairman and CEO BB&T Corporation John A. Allison's review resonates with me. The most important issue in our society today is the morality of capitalism. Free Market Revolution lays bare how capitalism is the only economic system consistent with man's nature as a thinking being who must act in his long-term rational self-interest to survive and prosper. This is an important book which integrates philosophical ideas with their real-world consequences. The book will be available after the event for purchase and for signing. Dr. Yaron Brook is the executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute. He is a columnist at Forbes, and his articles have been featured in the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, Investors Business Daily, and many other publications. He is a frequent guest on national radio and television programs and is a co-author of Neoconservatism, An Obituary for an Idea, and a contributing author to Winning the Unwinnable War, America's Self-Crippled Response to Islamic Totalitarianism. Dr. Brook is a co-author with ARI fellow Don Watkins of the national bestseller Free Market Revolution, How Ayn Rand's Ideas Can End Big Government. A former finance professor, he speaks internationally on such topics as the causes of the financial crisis, the morality of capitalism, ending the growth of the state, and U.S. foreign policy. Dr. Brook was born and raised in Israel. He served as a first sergeant in Israel military intelligence and earned a BSc in civil engineering from Technion Israel Institute of Technology in Haifa. In 1987, he moved to the United States, where he received his MBA and PhD in finance from the University of Texas at Austin. He became an American citizen in 2003. For 7 years, he was an award-winning finance professor at Santa Clara University, and in 1998, he co-founded a financial advisory firm, BH Equity Research, of which he is presently managing director and chairman. And now, kindly turn off your cell phones and other electronic devices, and it is with great pleasure that I introduce Dr. Yaron Brook.
Thank you, Doris. Thank you all for coming tonight. I know L.A. has lots of distractions. It's always a challenge to get an audience in Los Angeles. So I want to read you a quote, and I want you to think about who said this. I need to take my glasses off of this. What is the secular basis of Judaism? Practical need, self-interest. What is the worldly religion of the Jew? Huckstering. What is his worldly God? money. Later in the same essay, the bill of exchange is the real God of the Jew. The chimerical nationality of the Jew is the nationality of the merchant, of the man of money in general. Anybody want to take a stab at who?
Karl Marx.
Wow. This is like the best read audience I've ever met. I've never had anybody guess that. That is Karl Marx. A Jew. Karl Marx was a Jew. Karl Marx linked Judaism with self-interest, greed, capitalism, banking, merchant, trading. For Karl Marx, the Jew was the symbol of capitalism. He writes in this essay, the essay is called On the Question, on the Jewish Question, right? This is an essay on the Jewish question. And it's an essay where he's discussing the emancipation of the Jews in Germany. Should the Jews be emancipated in Germany? This is 1843, right? And he says, basically, the Jews have taken over all of society. The Christians have become Jews. And what he means by that, the Christians have become capitalists. What we need, he says, is to emancipate society from Judaism, right? In other words, to emancipate society from capitalism. Only then can we emancipate the Jew, in a sense, from himself. So what Karl Marx does is he connects capitalism and Judaism. And that connection is with us every day today. Now, Karl Marx was not original here. This didn't start with Karl Marx. If you go back and read Martin Luther, Martin Luther talks about the Jew in terms of money, in terms of trade, in terms of greed. Now, trade is not a virtue for Martin Luther, right? In terms of banking, in terms of usury, in terms of interest. All, in his perspective, negative. But it goes back even further than that. It goes back, when Dante writes the Inferno, Dante's Inferno, right? He places the moneylender in the seventh rung of hell with a bag of money wrapped around his throat, dragging him down to hell. And almost any illustration you see, artwork, of Dante's Inferno, that moneylender being dragged down to hell is not just, it's not Aryan features that characterize his face. Clearly Jewish features. So even Dante, going way back. And of course, one of Shakespeare's most famous plays, right? The Merchant of Venice, as Shylock, the Jewish moneylender, as its clear villain. Now, you know, sometimes you can act Shylock as being sympathetic, but Shakespeare means him to be a villain. He is the bad guy, filled with resentment and daring to do what? What is Shylock's real sin? As his Christian, merchant accuses him, he dares to charge interest on the loans that he gives Christians. Now, I think this connection between anti-Semitism and money, anti-Semitism and capitalism, anti-Semitism and the banker, is very deeply rooted. I believe that one of the main causes, there are many causes of anti-Semitism, but one of the main causes of anti-Semitism, go back deep into the Middle Ages, into when Christians were banned from doing any banking. Christians were banned from doing any money lending. Christians were banned from charging interest on money. Why were they banned? Well, there's a statement in the Old Testament where God tells the Jews, thou shalt not charge interest on debt from your brothers. Right? So you're not allowed to charge any interest on loans that you give to your brothers. Now, the Jews of those times took brother to mean what? What did Jews take brother to mean? Other Jews. So Jews said, yeah, we can't charge interest of other Jews, but we can charge interest of the goyim. They're not Jews. Anybody who's not a Jew, we can charge interest. So the Jews view this as a practical, legitimate, authorized by God profession to give interest, to charge interest on loans. Christians, though, When they hear brother, what do they mean? Christianity is a universal religion. Judaism is not. Judaism does not apply to everybody. It applies only to the chosen people. Christianity is a universal religion. So brother means everybody, Christian or not. So the Christian is banned from charging interest. The Christian is banned from being a banker. That profession is banned by the Catholic Church during... I mean, the Catholic Church only recognized the legitimacy of charging interest on a bank loan in the late 19th century. Right? Up until then, it was considered a mortal sin. Now, as some of you might know, they did it all the time, right? The monks were some of the biggest bankers of all time. But just like Islamic banking, which doesn't allow charging interest, they found cute little gimmicks to get around calling it interest while still charging it. So who are the money lenders of the Middle Ages? Almost uniformly, the bankers, the money lenders of the Middle Ages are Jews. Which means a Christian who needs money, who needs fund. And we know, I mean, most of you probably are in business. You know that to run a business, to be active commercially, you need to borrow money sometimes. Debt is an important instrument in facilitating trade. And as the Western world starts recovering during the Middle Ages and during the Renaissance from the fall of Rome, economic activity starts happening and people start needing funds. They can't go to their brother Christians to get it. They have to go to the Jew. So the Jew immediately is labeled as committing a mortal sin. Seventh rung of heaven, seventh rung of hell, right? Really, really bad stuff. And the Christian is in an inferior position because he owes the Jew money now and it needs to pay him interest, which again, according to the Christian, should not exist. It shouldn't happen. The psychological resentment building up, right? And the Jew is wealthy. I don't know how many of you have read Ivanhoe. And the hero in Ivanhoe is a Jewish money lender and his daughter who lends money to the king to fund wars and everything. I mean, if you look at that period of time, the Jews dominate the financial industry. And not surprising, they continue to dominate the financial industry to some extent to this day. So all the grievances towards finance, all grievances towards bankers, all grievances towards the economic activity that is the financial world is associated with Jews. And therefore leads to this deep resentment of the Jew. And this is Karl Marx is capitalizing on almost, 1,500 years, if not 2,000 years, of deep, deep resentment towards this idea. So you've got a Christian world that resents Jews because they're the money lenders and because they're the bankers. And, why is it? What is it about money lending? What is it about banking that is so offensive to people? And because this is crucial, particularly in the modern world. I mean, I tell audiences all the time when I talk about the financial crisis and so on. People always, for 2,000 years, every financial and economic crisis we've ever had, who do we blame? Before we even hear any economic facts, before we collected the data, before we know anything about what actually happened, who do we blame? I mean, who did the New York Times blame? Who did the Europeans blame? Who did everybody blame? In 2008, 2009, immediately when the financial crisis, nobody's actually looked at the data, investigated. We knew who was to blame, right? It was bankers. Now, they didn't say Jewish bankers because that's not politically correct. But it's Goldman Sachs, right? It's Jewish bankers implicitly. But that's not new to this financial crisis. Who caused the Great Depression? Legit question. Who caused the Great Depression? Not people who know. Who caused the Great Depression? I mean, what are we taught in high school? What was the instinctual response in 1930 to who caused the Great Depression? 1931, 1932? Stock market. It was the Wall Street. It was bankers. Bankers caused the Great Depression. We know this. And in 1933, 1944, we reaped huge amounts of regulation on bankers because we blamed the Great Depression on bankers. Just like Dodd-Frank was the solution, in quotes, to the financial crisis. Now, no serious economist today, and I don't count Paul Krugman in that statement. No serious economist today believes that the Great Depression was caused by Wall Street. Most economists today realize that the Great Depression was caused by the Federal Reserve, and then followed on by really bad policies by Hoover, and then really disastrous policies by FDR that deepened the recession and made it much worse and turned it into a Great Depression that lasted until 1945. And you can ask me about the Great Depression if you want in the Q&A. No serious economist, 10 years from now, will look back at this financial crisis and say it was caused by bankers. And you ask me if you want what did cause the financial crisis.
The government kept interest rates way too low, and they forced people to buy homes that shouldn't buy homes.
Sure. But the story is that there was greed on Wall Street in 2006 and 2007. It was greedy Wall Street bankers that caused the financial crisis. And I ask a simple question. Was greed invented in 06? I mean, aren't Wall Street bankers always greedy? If greed means they wanted more money, hasn't that always been the case? That's what bankers are about, right? They're about doing what? Making money. They're about making money. Right? So nothing new happened in 06 and 07 that changed on Wall Street. So you have to look at why it is that in 06 and 07, them trying to make money caused the financial crisis. And it has nothing to do, it has much more to do with the Federal Reserve and the bank regulations and a whole slew of things. There are a lot of reasons why the financial crisis happened, irrespective.
I heard a small banker speak, and the government basically said, you guys have to loan money for people to buy homes, knowing that these people were too poor to buy.
Yeah, and I've got an 8-hour course on the causes of the financial crisis. It's online for free if anybody's really interested, because you can go on that. So, anti-Semitism, in my view, a major cause of anti-Semitism, in my view, is linked to the fact that Jews were bankers. Bankers are always hated because bankers are about what? Because, again, the Great Depression caused by them or blamed on them. The financial crisis right now is blamed on them. Every financial crisis in the last 2,000 years has been blamed on bankers. Why? Why do we hate bankers, and therefore, by extension, why do we hate Jews so much? What is it about banking? What is it about finance? What is it about charging interest on money that is so despicable, that is so horrific, that A, we regulate them to death, right? And B, we blame everything on them, and we extend this to the whole issue of anti-Semitism, right? And you could read reams of this stuff connecting bankers and Jews to this day. The conspiracy theorists believe that Jewish bankers control the world. You can find all this online. I'm kidding. What is it about bankers we hate so much? What do bankers do? What is the purpose of their business?
To make money.
To make money. What is the purpose of all business under capitalism? To make money. For whom? For yourself, right? For yourself. Now, it's not just about money, because a lot of you are in business and you don't only care about money. What else do you care about? I mean, you enjoy it. You enjoy it. You enjoy the creative process. You enjoy the challenge. You know, but it's about whom? It's about you. And when we as consumers, and this relates to the whole issue of the hatred of capitalism, when we as consumers go out into the marketplace to buy stuff, you know, to consume, who do we care about? So I don't know how many about you, but when I go to the mall to buy stuff, I'm doing it out of a sense of caring for my fellow man, because I want to make sure people have jobs. You know, I consume to stimulate the economy and to make sure the clerks have jobs and the Hugo Boss does well and so on. I mean, why do you go to the mall?
Self-interest.
So what is the marketplace about? The marketplace. From the Turkish marketplace where you can see them haggling all the way to Saks Fifth Avenue. What is every form of marketplace in between those two? What is it about? It's about people pursuing their self-interest. People selling because they want to make money. because they enjoy producing stuff, and people buying because they want to make their life better. Capitalism, banking, marketplace is all about self-interest. It's about making money. And when I say banking is about making money, we feel uncomfortable. When I say going to the mall because I want to make, you know, it's all about self-interest, I want to make my life better, it's uncomfortable. And that's weird that it's uncomfortable. But that's the key. We've been taught that self-interest, that pursuing one's self-interest somehow is tainted. This is somehow bad. I mean, notice what Marx says about Jews. What characterizes the Jew? Before he gets the money, self-interest. Self-interest is a bad word. Self-interest is a bad word. I mean, I was taught when I was growing up, my mother, good Jewish mother, and she taught me, think of yourself last. Think of others first. Be selfless. Now, she didn't mean it. Nobody does. Nobody wants their child to think of themselves last. Nobody means it, right? But that's what we've been taught is right. That's what's just. That's what's noble. That's what morality means. And we live split lives. We live a life where we pursue our selfish, self-interested ends. And we don't live the life of being selfless. And what does that cause?
Guilt.
We feel guilty because we should be selfless, but we're not. Our mother taught us to be selfless, but she didn't really mean it, so we're not. Right? I mean, I go to these award dinners for businessmen. And Lifetime Achievement Awards, right? And there's a room full of businessmen, and they read these long bios. And you guys might have been at these dinners and maybe have received some of these awards. And a 10-minute bio, right? 10 long bio. And they'll read the bio, and they'll spend about a minute to 2 minutes on your business achievements and 8 minutes on your community service and charity. Now, with all due respect to community service and charity, where have you touched the world more? In your business or in your community service and charity? What builds a country? What raises people out of poverty? Charity or business? Business. You'll touch many more lives in your business. You'll improve many more lives in your business. I'm not against charity and community service, but that should be a minute, maybe 30 seconds, and the rest should be about your business success. You took care of yourself. You took care of your family. You built something to be proud of. You had employees. You had suppliers. You had customers. All of their lives are better off because you existed, because you were in business. And yet you get zero moral credit for that. Of course, that's where you made your money, so you can be charitable. But we value the charity, not the making. The making is the making selfish. It's self-interested. That doesn't count. I mean, the best example of this is Bill Gates. Bill Gates made for himself, I don't know, $70 billion for himself, right? That's how much money he made at Microsoft. Now, what did he do at Microsoft? What did Microsoft do? Did it help people? Is there anybody on the planet who wasn't helped by Microsoft? Probably not. He's probably helped billions of people. Their life is marginally better off because Microsoft existed. All of us have been touched by Microsoft. We all use a product by Microsoft. If we don't use a Microsoft product, we've used a product that's influenced by Microsoft because they were the innovators. They drew it forward. We're all better off because of Microsoft. Does Bill Gates get any moral credit for helping us? No, because he's just a businessman, and he made money helping us. So helping us, 7 billion people, but he made money at it, that doesn't get any moral credit. Actually, it gets negative moral credit. He's actually a bad guy. What a greedy bastard. He's got $70 billion. Now, the fact that he probably created tens of trillions of dollars of wealth for all of us, that's irrelevant, because he made $70 billion. When does Bill Gates become a good guy? When he starts a foundation. Now, he has to leave Microsoft, and he goes and runs the foundation to give the money away. Now he's a good guy. The fact that he created it, that doesn't count. That doesn't give him anything. The fact that he's giving away, that's moral, that's noble, that's good. But it's worse than that. Because where do you think he'll help more people? I mean, I'm sure the foundation does wonderful things. It helps, it saves kids from malaria in Africa and so on. But in this foundation, he'll maybe help thousands of people, maybe tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people. But Microsoft helped hundreds of millions of people. Yet he gets negative credit for that, and for his foundation, he gets positive credit. And how would we get Bill Gates to be a moral hero? Yeah, I mean, one of the problems right now with Bill Gates is he looks like he's having fun running this foundation. But if he gave it all away, moved into a tent, and could show a little blood, then we'd say, wow, that's noble. That is real sacrifice. Now there's a good guy. We live in a culture, and we've been living in a culture for 2,000 years, that resents money-making because it resents self-interest. It resents Jews because they're perceived to be money-making and self-interested. We live in a culture that resents the making, the creating, the building, and glorifies the giving, the charity. I mean, charity is an insignificant part of the world. I mean, that's a fact. I mean, in 1776, the United States was a third-rate colony, pretty poor, insignificant, so insignificant the British didn't really send their big army to fight us. Right? They were too busy with big countries like France and so on. Right? By 1914, we were the mightiest industrial military power in the world. 150 years. What did that? What created that? Charity and community service, right? In 1776, 95% of the population of the world was dirt poor. 95 is too generous. 99% of the population of the world was dirt poor. Subsistence farming, life expectancy of under 40 years old. Nothing. No running water. No electricity. Nothing. You worked from morning to night. People think capitalism invented child labor. What did children do before capitalism? They worked on the farm if they lived. Most of them died before the age of 10. From sunrise to sunset. By 1914, life expectancy had doubled. By 1914, at least in the West, by the standards of 1776, nobody was poor. Almost everybody had running water. Many, many people had electricity. There were sewage systems. People started having automobiles. Henry Ford was just about to revolutionize automobiles so that everybody could have one. What did that? What allowed 99% of the people to rise out of poverty? Community service and charity? No, capitalism. Greedy, self-interested business. That's what we should be proud of. Yet we're ashamed of. We're embarrassed of. So what we have today, what we've had for 2,000 years, is an ethic inconsistent with being a banker, with being a capitalist, with being in business, with being self-interested, with being, according to Marx, a Jew. In my view, a perverse ethic. A perverse ethic. Why should I think of myself last? I would ask my mother around age 16 when, you know, the hormones kick in and I was going to challenge her. Why should I think of myself last? Why should I think of other people's first? Why are they more important than me? Why is sacrifice noble? Why? And you know what the answer was?
Because.
Because. And what is... What?
Judaism demands a balance. Hillel said,
But Judaism.
I'm not for myself to move reforming.
I'm not going to argue about Judaism because Judaism is irrelevant because Judaism doesn't dominate the culture, right? Judaism doesn't dominate the culture. Judaism is an insignificant portion of the moral views in the culture. Even if you're right, and you are right. I think Judaism is night and day. Pre-Christianity Judaism is night and day better than Christianity from a moral perspective. But that's not the issue. We Jews don't dominate this culture. This culture is dominated by Christian morality. This culture is dominated by the morality of sacrifice, by the morality of selflessness, and we can see it in the way we approach it. Now, Jews, in my view, kind of off the record, have become Christianized. We've adopted that morality. Whether Hillel said it or not, who cares? He lived 2,000 years ago, and he's irrelevant to our discussion today. The fact is, the Jews feel more guilty about the wealth they produce than any Christian does. I mean, why are Jews so left-wing? We have a better class of Jew in this room. Why? But overwhelmingly, you're the tiniest of minority, right? You're the tiniest of minority. Why are Jews so left-wing? Because they bought into this. They feel guilty for their wealth. I mean, this is consistent. Why is Israel so hated by Europe? I mean, just think of it in this way. What was Europe's attitude towards Israel before 1967? I assume everybody knows the 67 war, right? What was Europe's... I mean, where did Israel buy weapons from? Who did Israel buy weapons from before 1967? France. Czechoslovakia was really old. That was in 1948. But in before 67, Israel fought in 67 with Mirage airplanes, French, with British tanks, with German weapons. The Europeans loved Israel before 1967. And actually, I don't know how many of you remember this, but America had a weapons embargo in Israel. America refused to sell weapons to Israel until after 1967. Now, what happened in 1967 that caused the Europeans to hate Israel? Because they hate Israel today. I mean, you go to Europe, it's awful. The left, which dominates Europe, is so anti-Israel. And you could argue anti-Semitic, but so anti-Israel. Why? Why are they so anti-Israel? What happened in 1967 that made them flip?
Self-interest.
The Jews were not pathetic, miserable people anymore. They won. They were strong. They were capable. We don't like strong, capable people. Because strong, capable people are what? Are self-interested. How do you get strong and capable? By looking after yourself. Looking after you. We resent success. And we resent Israel not for any vice that it did, not for any sin that it committed. The Europeans hate Israel not because of any bad thing that it did. They hate Israel because of its virtues. Because it's strong, because it's capable, because it's able, because it's independent. That's what they hate about it. They hate it for its virtue. And that's what they hate the Jew. That's what they hate the banker. Because they're capable, because they're rich, because they're successful, because they've created something. And it all boils down to an ethic that says, the meek shall inherit the earth. The meek are the virtuous. The poor are the good guys. Why? Because they're not self-interested. They haven't pursued money. They haven't pursued wealth. They haven't pursued greed. So to me, it's all about the ethics. If you care about capitalism, if you care about freedom, it's not about economics. The economics are easy. We won the economic debate 100 years ago. Over 100 years ago. We know capitalism works. You have eyes, you can see capitalism works. Go to Hong Kong, you can see capitalism works. East Berlin, West Berlin, you can see. You know, today, for kids, you have to tell them, you know, they built the wall not to prevent West Berliners from going to East Berlin because, you know, socialism is so admired today, they probably thought all our Westerners were fleeing into communist Germany. I mean, we know it works, and yet we turn our backs to it. And it doesn't matter, Republicans, Democrats, they all hate capitalism. They all resent capitalism. They all work against capitalism. Every single one of them. I mean, government always grows. It doesn't matter who's in power. Because morally, it's uncomfortable. It's wrong. It's about self-interest. And self-interest is unacceptable. So if we care about capitalism, if we care about freedom, and for that matter, if we care about anti-Semitism, what we should be advocating is the opposite of what Marx advocates for. Marx wants the rejection of the self. Marx wants the rejection of self-interest. He wants all of us to unify into, to be emancipated from our self-interest, emancipated from our ego, emancipated from our own identity, and merge into, have you ever seen Star Trek? The Borg, right? The collective, the unthinking masses, the proletarian, which in his vision is just an unthinking mass. Unthinking masses always need what? Leaders, by the way. And the same with the Nazis, right? I mean, it's the same. Nazi Party was the Socialist Party. It was the National Socialist Party. These are just variations of socialism. That's all they are. Communism, Nazism. What we need to do is reject that idea, the collectivistic idea, the altruistic idea, the idea that human beings, individual human beings, are just cog in some collective machine. That others are more important than self. That you are your brother's keeper. No, I'm not. Not even my real brother. He can take care of himself. If he wants my help, he can ask. And it's not guaranteed. Depends if he's a good guy or not. Certainly not strangers. I'm not the keeper. I might be willing to help them. But is my moral obligation above and beyond what I might have to do for my kids or for myself? No, absolutely not. That whole morality has to be rejected. And what we need to replace it with is a morality of individualism, true individualism. A morality that says, no, the unit of measurement, the unit that's important, is the individual human being. My happiness is the standard of my morality. My life is what my morality is about. Yes, I am self-interested and proud of it, because I believe that's what morality should be about. It should teach me how to be self-interested. Now, Ayn Rand articulates this, but this is not new. This goes back to the Greeks. Aristotle. For Aristotle, what's morality about? Serving others? No. It's about flourishing, individual flourishing. It's about what are the virtues, right? What are the virtues that a human being needs to adopt, the values he needs to seek, so he can be the happiest, most successful, flourishing person that he can possibly be. That's what morality is about. And to the extent Judaism is pretty good, it's because it's Aristotelian, or you can, there's a relationship there, right? It's about individual human flourishing, individual human success, individual human prosperity. And then if you want to help other people, fine. If it's part of that flourishing, if it's part of what it means for you to be successful and you to be good. But it doesn't start with other people, it starts with you. A morality of individualism, a morality that says, no, my moral purpose in life is to be the best human being I can be, is a morality that doesn't envy the other person for what he has. If I mean, my approach to really rich people, I'm not very rich, but my approach to other rich people is, yay, isn't that cool? And why is it yay? Because I know that every rich people out there, assuming he's made it honestly and assuming he's not in the pocket of the government, the way he's made his money is by what? The only way to make money is by what? It's by making my life better. And if it hasn't made my life better, it's made my kid's life better or somebody else's life better. Because the only way you make money is by selling a product somebody else wants. And let's say you sell your product for $100. How much is it worth to the person buying it? More than 100, otherwise they wouldn't bother to give you 100. So they're getting something at $100 that's worth more to them, and what are you getting? Something that was worth less. I mean, you sold something that was worth less, and you're getting more. So you're making a profit, and they're making a profit. Win-win. We're all better off. How cool is that? That should be celebrated. Right? So when I see somebody rich, I'm saying, wow, he created lots of product that people really wanted. He made lots of people's life better off. Probably my better life better off. Good for him. That's terrific. But if I am a altruist in a sense of if my whole focus in life is other people, then I'm going, he's got a lot of money, I've got a little. His moral obligation is to help me. How come he's not doing that? How come he's not writing me a check? I resent that. He should be writing me a check. So I hate him. I want the money. It's not, and that's absurd. So the whole orientation shifts. And by being self-interested, what do we mean, right? And this is not a trick question. Was Bernie Madoff selfish? Self-interested?
No, self-destructive.
Yeah, well.
Yes.
Thank you. You say yes. So Bernie Madoff sat down one day, and he said, how can I make my life the best life that it could be? How can I live a happy, prosperous, flourishing life? And he said, you know, I'll do it by cheating and lying and stealing from my best friends. No, he didn't. Of course he didn't. What Bernie Madoff did is he never thought. Thinking was not part of what Bernie Madoff did. What Bernie Madoff did, he saw a pile of money. And he said, I want that. And he took it. He didn't think that was going to make his life glorious. He actually, though, if you look at all these schemes and how they work, they start out small. And I just want a little bit because I want this and that. And then bigger and bigger. And was he happy? At any point in the scheme, was he happy? No, he was miserable. If you ask Bernie Madoff, he'll tell you he's happier in jail than he was before he was caught. How many of you ever lied? Don't. It sucks. It's a bad policy. You don't get what you want when you lie. You mess up it for you and you mess up for the people you're lying to. And you almost always get caught. And that's not pleasant. If you lie in business, nobody does business with you anymore. Lying is not a successful strategy for a successful, flourishing life. Neither stealing, neither is any of these things. The bad stuff, right? It doesn't work. It's bad policy. What is good policy? What's good policy? What leads? What is it that makes us human? What does it make it possible for us to survive, to thrive, to be successful?
Trust and ethics.
Trust and ethics. This is before ethics, though. Before there was ethics. Because ethics is a conceptual. Ethics is something somebody has to think up. Something has to,
you know.
Rationality. Instinct. Okay, it's a survival instinct. This is good. So look around the room.
Integrity.
No, I like the survival instinct. I want to go a little bit with this survival instinct. Look around the room. Right? You can look. We're a pathetic species. We're weak. We're slow. We have no fangs. We have no claws. Our survival instinct put me up against a saber-toothed tiger. I'm dead. Try running down a bison and biting into it. We do not have the instincts or the physical ability to survive in nature. What do we have that allows us to beat the saber-toothed tiger, to catch the bison, to skin it, to make clothes, to eat the food, and to build bison burger bars at hotels? Thinking. We have a mind. What makes us human, what makes every human value that we have possible is human reason. It's our ability to reason. It's our ability to think. It's our ability to figure stuff out. I mean, I saw the bison. I want to eat it. I can't catch it. I can't bite into it. So what do? I invent a bow and arrow. I invent a spear. I figure out with my other tribe members how to trap it, right? I hunt it down. All of that requires what? An Einstein. A genius. I mean, none of that is easy. None of that is easy. There are no genes for that. No instincts for that. I have no idea how to make these clothes. None. There's no gene in me that tells me. You put me in the middle of the Amazon, naked in the Amazon, I'd probably die in hours because I don't know any of this stuff. I'd have to figure it all out. But that's what we have this for. So if you're really self-interested, if you really want to have a flourishing life, if you really want to be successful in life, if you really want to do good, what do you have to do? What's the number one most important thing you should do?
Think.
Use your mind to educate yourself. Figure stuff out. But use your mind in everything. And why is lying so horrific? Because lying is the negation of this. You know, there's a saying in computer science, garbage in, garbage out. Lying is garbage in. I mean, I at my age, some of you are older than me, so you appreciate this, right? I at my age barely remember what I did last week. I mean, this is true. Right? Now imagine if I lied about what I did last week. I couldn't, because I'd have to remember two things instead of one. But it's actually more than two things, because you'd have to remember who you lied to and who you didn't, why you lied to them, why you didn't lie to other people. It's impossible to cope. I mean, if you really value your mind and you want to save it for the real decisions you have to make in life, you have to be honest, because honesty is easy. You only have to remember one thing, what actually happened. And that's hard enough for me these days. So if you value your mind, you don't steal, because if you value your mind, you want to know that you can take care of yourself. You want to know you can produce your own food. In a hunter-gatherer, you know, context, you want to know you can hunt the bison down. Or you can do something and trade with the hunter so you can get the meat. But you owned it. But when you steal, what are you telling yourself? I can't make it. I can't make it. I need to use force, which everybody universally recognizes as evil, in order to take something from somebody else who did make it, who did produce it. Nobody who steals is happy. Nobody who steals is flourishing. They might exhibit symptoms of happiness, but they're not happy. Because happiness requires a deep self-esteem that comes only when you can produce, when you can create, when you can build, when you can make something. If you can't do that, you're flat. And the people who value this in history, what culture has valued the human mind? Yeah, I mean, the Greeks did, and the Jews did. Right? Another reason not to like us very much, because the other cultures don't. They don't view the human mind as that important. Morality, if you look at the regular morality that we teach in Introduction to Morality 101 at every university in the globe, the mind, reason, rationality never comes up. Nobody ever talks about that. That's irrelevant. That's selfish. That's self-interested. That's how you take care of yourself. Taking care of yourself has nothing to do with morality, they tell you. But that's the enemy. That is the real enemy. Israel is hated because it takes care of itself, because it's strong and competent. Jews are being hated throughout history because they take care of themselves. They're smart. They value being smart, and they take care of themselves. And they go out there, and they're successful in life. Note that right after 67, who became the favorites of the Europeans? Why? Did the Europeans care one iota about the Palestinians? I mean, as people? No, because they're pathetic now. They're the ones who are weak. They're the ones who are suffering. They're the ones who are meek. The meek shall inherit the earth. Always go for the meek. They're the underdogs. Never admire strength. Always love weakness. That's the ethical motto of our time. And that's an ethical motto that's inconsistent with capitalism, inconsistent with banking, inconsistent with Wall Street.
Inconsistent with reality.
And that's why we move away from capitalism. For 100 years, we've been moving away from capitalism. In spite of all its successes, we've been destroying capitalism systematically, with this president accelerating that process even faster than any other. For 100 years, I'll get to questions in a minute. 100 years, we've been moving away from capitalism. For 100 years, we've been moving away from the idea of individual sovereignty and individual ownership over your own life and what that means. Because we've let this morality infect us. Note that anti-Semitism is strongest in the countries that are least capitalist. This is true throughout history. Why did Jews all come to America? In the 19th century, where there were no regulations, no safety net, tiny little government, about 10% of what it is today in terms of percent of GDP. 10% of what it is today. You could shrink the American government by 90% and you'd go back to the government that we had in 150, 130 years ago. Why did Jews come here? Everybody came here. Because of the freedom. Because There was still anti-Semitism here, but it was so much less than what they exhibited in Europe, where it's statist, socialist controlled. Do you know what's happening to the Jewish community in Venezuela since Chavez has been around? There's 7,000 Jews left in Venezuela. It used to be one of the most prosperous Jewish communities in Latin America. But they were attacked. They were persecuted. They've left. You go country after country after country, where you have statism and socialism, you get the Jews are blamed, and the Jews have to escape, and the Jews leave. And where do they go to? They go to the countries where there's freedom, where there's capitalism. So if we care about capitalism, we care about freedom, if we care about anti-Semitism, we should be advocates of a new morality. I'm an advocate. I mean, I wrote a book called Free Market Revolution. But the revolution is not economic. We won the economic argument a long time ago, those of us who believe in capitalism. The revolution is a moral revolution. The revolution is rejection of the idea that your life doesn't belong to you, a rejection of the idea that you are your brother's keeper, that you're your brother's servant, that you owe it to society, that society is the standard. And an adoption of the idea that's implicit in the founding of this country, the greatest country, in my view, in human history. Because this country was not founded on the idea of maximizing social utility or the idea of egalitarianism, of equality of outcome, or the idea of your brother's keeper. That's not in the Declaration of Independence. What is in the Declaration of Independence? Whose happiness? Social? Whatever the hell that means. Happiness? No. What's in the Declaration of Independence is every individual's right, by his very nature, to his own life. What does a right to life mean? Put aside what the left would like us to pretend that it means. What does it really mean? It means the right to live your life as you see fit, based on your values, in pursuit of rational values that will promote your life. Without what? What does it exclude? What's not allowed? Force. If you have a right to something, nobody can force you not to have it. So right to life means the right to be free to act based on your values in pursuit of your life, in pursuit of making your life better. And you have a right, an inalienable right, which means what? Inalienable means what? I have to remind people this, right? That it cannot be voted away. Even 99% of the people voting against it cannot extinguish it because it's part of your nature. It's part of what you are as a human being. It's a requirement of your survival as a human being. So it can't be voted away. You have a right to your life, you have a right to your liberty, which means you have a right to think what you want to think. And nobody has a right to tell you what to think. And it's not just about thought, it's about acting on those thoughts. As long as you're not cursing somebody else, as long as you're not committing fraud on somebody else, it's nobody's business what you think and what you act. Because thought, reason, rationality is what it's all about. That's what life is about. That's what progress and success and prosperity are about. And in the most self-interested, selfish political statement in human history, each one of us has an inalienable right to pursue our own happiness. Our own happiness, not other people's happiness. To make our lives the best lives that they can be. And nobody has a right to stop us by using force. What the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution try to do is extract, eliminate force from our society. And the founders understood that the biggest enemy was government, because the biggest extractor of force was government. Always has been, always will be. And they try to shield us from it, and we've abandoned that notion. What we need is to resurrect that. So if you care about anti-Semitism, you should be advocates for capitalism. And if you care about capitalism, you should be advocates for self-interest. You should be advocates for the pursuit of happiness. Thank you all. Take questions.
I just wait, if you would kindly speak into the microphone. So can...
He was waiting patiently.
John, I will get to everybody.
Thank you, Your Honor. What do you think of the interpretation of European Palestinianism, that this marks paid to the Holocaust, because we see no European Tibetanism, no European North Koreanism. There are all sorts of those who might be described as meek.
Sure.
It's a misuse of terming, so within the context of what lecture, we understand that, you know, there are disadvantaged and extremely oppressed peoples. And the Europeans have no room whatsoever in a sliver of their consciousness for these people. But the Palestinians, that can mark paid in full to one of the greatest crimes in history.
Well, note that it's not just Europeans. I mean, the American left does this exactly the same thing. And so this is what I think you have to understand about the left. And it's very difficult to understand this because it's, at least for me, it's so outside of my experience, right? The left is not motivated by love. It's not that the left cares one iota about the Palestinians. It's not that they love the Palestinians. The left is motivated by hate and by hatred, by envy, by resentment, by negativity. Marx doesn't love the proletarian. He was never experienced the life of a proletarian. He doesn't know what the proletarians do, or he doesn't give one iota about them. What he hates are the capitalists. What he hates are the Jews. What the Europeans do is they hate the Jews. They've always hated Jews for a very long time. They hate Israel because it's successful. And they love the Palestinians because they're the enemy of Israel. Right? They don't love, for example, poor Iranians who are being oppressed by the mullahs. And quite the contrary. When Khomeini came to power, European intellectuals, loved the guy. I mean, just read some of the French existentialists. I mean, they thought Khomeini was God's gift to the planet, because he mingled his Islamism with socialism, because he was very clever. He, you know, part of his campaign was to get the left in Iran with him to depose the Shah, and they formed a coalition. And then very quickly, as soon as he established his power, he killed them all off. But he used the language of the left in order to get them. But they loved him. But they don't care about oppressed people, as you said, anywhere else. Why do they care about the Palestinians? Because they hate the Israelis. Why do they hate Israel? Because they're successful and powerful. But what really irks them is they're successful, powerful, and they're Jewish. Because Jews represent something. They represent, as Marx points out, the self-interested capitalist in their mind, which is what they hate. Because, it's the same thing in France. It's not just Jews they hate there. They hate successful people. People talk about Scandinavia, the utopia of Scandinavia. But in Scandinavia, if you're wealthy, you better be driving a Fiat. Because if you drive a really nice car in Scandinavia, they'll scratch it. They'll vandalize it. These wonderful, calm, friendly, blonde, blue-eyed Swedes hate the wealthy. There is massive resentment. And it's this envy. It's this hatred of success, which is what motivates all these cultures. I mean, Hitler didn't love the Aryans. He didn't care one iota about the German people. He hated life. He hated existence. People are, and this is what good people, it's hard for them to imagine, because we don't, hatred is not part of the way we think about the world. We think about the world as positives, values, as good things, as good people. We try to, but literally, bad, the whole motivation behind socialism, the whole motivation about statism is a hatred of the good.
Just a quick question that, based on what he was saying, is it true that there really are no quote unquote Palestinians? It's just a made up name by Arafat or somebody else, and it's all.
Look, I know a lot of people think that. I'm not a big. It doesn't matter to me. I don't care what they call themselves. There was a Palestine. The British called it Palestine. There were Arabs who lived in Palestine. They're Palestinians. Arabs who live in Palestine, right?
The Jews were the Palestinians.
And Jews were Palestinians, and they considered themselves Palestinians.
The Jews were the Palestinians.
In those days, the Jews were the Palestinians, yes, and the Arabs were Arabs because they lived under the Ottoman Empire. But you know what? Before the 19th century, the Germans, there was no Germans. So what do we say? Germans are an illegitimate concept because before the 19th century, there was no such, there was Bavarians and this type and that type, and they were all little city-states. They came together under the nationalistic fervor of the 19th century, and they defined themselves as German. So I don't resent the Palestinians coming together and saying, we want to adopt a national identity called Palestinians that relates to this geographic area. That's not the problem. The problem is they want to kill us. I don't care what they call themselves. If you want to kill me, I'm going to kill you first. I mean, it's got nothing to do with names, and the more we obsess about names and about, well, are they Palestinians or not, we lose the battle because it's not important. If the Palestinians were peace-loving, freedom-loving capitalists, then the solution to the Palestinian problem is a one-state solution, and let's all kumbaya together around the bonfire. But that's not who they are. That's not their identity, and that's the reality. We need to identify what they are and what they represent. Yasser Arafat, the problem with Yasser Arafat is not that he was a Palestinian nationalist. The problem with Yasser Arafat is he has the blood of babies and children on his hands. And he should have hung. I mean, I hope Israel executed him. It's too bad they had to do it stealthily. They should have made it a public execution so everybody sees what's done to evil people. Like they did with Eichmann. They didn't have to hang Eichmann, but they did. Right? They should have done the same with Yasser Arafat. But now you're getting me off track and all emotional. Yeah.
Okay, so I agree with you in your premise, but I don't think that we can also deny that the Torah does have some aspects of anti-capitalism or, shall we say, socialist behavior. So, see, Judaism and capitalism, you know, from the Shemitah to the Jubilee to, you know, leaving a corner of the field, etc. So how do you...
Look, I'm not a defender of Judaism qua religion. You know, I respect and admire Jewish culture that respects the mind, that respects reason, respects learning. But I'm no fan of the Jewish religion. I mean, the Torah has a lot of problems in it, right? There's no freedom of speech in the Torah. When Moses comes down from the mountain with the Ten Commandments, and some Jews have decided to worship a golden calf, Moses doesn't say, freedom of speech. You want to worship a golden calf? Fine. We won't talk to you. We'll shun you. Whatever. No. He and Aaron take out swords and they butcher, I can't remember the number, but thousands. Why? For the sin of having a different point of view than he did. And God rewards them for it. He makes Aaron and his brothers the Kohanim, right? So they get a price for it. So there's no relation. I mean, don't take anything I said as an endorsement of Judaism, qua Judaism. Judaism evolved. And the fact is that Judaism came to represent to the world outside, to the Marxists, to the European culture, it came to represent self-interest, money, capitalism. I wish it was that. Jews are not pro-capitalism. As we've said, Jews are primarily anti-capitalism. The Torah is not pro-capitalism. The Torah is pro-slavery. It has all sections in the Torah on how to treat your slave. It's not anti-slavery, okay? It's not anti-slavery. What's that?
It didn't outlaw slavery.
No, it didn't outlaw slavery, but that's the right thing to do if you really believed in individuals. So I'm not pro-Torah. Quite the contrary, right? I'm as somebody already pointed out to, you know, I'm an atheist. I don't believe, and I don't believe in any book as mystical revelation. The point is not what is Judaism. That's a whole other discussion we can have. And no two rabbis agree, so who am I, right? But the point is this is what Judaism came to represent for the West. And this is where anti-Semitism has its roots. Whether the Jews lived up to that or not is a completely different story. Right?
I enjoyed your talk very much.
Thank you.
Can I make a plea for one thing?
Sure.
Can we stop using the word capitalism? Was invented by a French leftist and picked up by Marx, and it's a pejorative term that the left likes to use against entrepreneurship and free markets. Can we stop using it with capitalism?
The problem.
Free markets, entrepreneurship, creativity.
But we're not about entrepreneurship. But entrepreneurship is an aspect of free markets, one aspect. There are many aspects of free markets. But look, it doesn't matter what term we use.
It does.
It doesn't. Because the left is going to smear no matter what we use. Capitalism, what does capital mean? In capital comes from Latin. What does capital mean? What's that? It means head. It means using your head. Capitalism is a system where people use their head. That's great. I mean, it's about using your mind. It's about creating stuff. That's what capitalism really means. And the capitalist, the guy with the money, is the guy who's used his head to create the most stuff. So I love the word capitalism, but I'm willing to go with free markets. But the left is going to slur free markets. They already do. Free of what? Free? They're not free. People starve under free markets. Free? They're not free of hunger. They're not free of suffering. They're not free of child labor. They'll smear anything we choose. The point is to fight them on the fundamentals, to fight them on not to give them an inch. And we give them not an inch. We give them yards and miles and whole and light years we give them. The microphone is there. Well, start moving to the front because there are a bunch of people here. Yeah.
So I think you're very accurate in saying that we need to advocate for a moral revolution and upholding the individualism and capitalism. And I think you're also accurate in saying that what we tend to do is to play a game kind of based on the prevailing moral terms. But my question is, what are the best strategies for us to confront and correct what is a collective financial psychosis? You used a very interesting description of force being associated with bad and stealing, and you started out talking about bankers and associating that with anti-Semitism and Judaism or Jews. And I was thinking about the idea that people take loans out of their own self-interest. Where is it that we conveniently forget that? When a bank forecloses on a loan or you can't pay or whatever else happens, you went into the deal because you needed something for your own self-interest, but they're the bad guys when it doesn't work out, and it becomes very toxic or... They're stealing from us.
Yeah, but this is the point, right? If self-interest is a bad thing, then yeah, I did it out of self-interest, but that was a moment of weakness. I needed that home, and they should have, if they were good Christians, given me the loan without the expectation of any interest. I mean, what does Jesus say? You know, don't expect to be repaid. Give loans without expecting to be repaid. So if the bank was good, was moral, was just, it wouldn't demand that I have to repay. I needed it. I'm struggling. So if we have a false conception of self-interest, if we view it as negative in the culture, we'll always have this relationship with the financial markets and with capitalism generally. And that's my argument. We have to change the way we view self-interest. We have to tell people, take your self-interest seriously. This is really about your self-interest. Is it in your self-interest to take out the loan? Make sure it is. Figure out the consequences. And I like to tell people this, particularly young people. Being selfish, and I use selfish on purpose to shock you a little bit. Right? Being selfish requires hard work. It's not about emotionally wanting the pile of money. That's not self-interest. That's just whim worship. It's self-destructive. It's what Bernie Madoff did. Self-interest is about thinking. It's about thinking, I'm going to live another 40 years, I hope. How am I going to make my life the best life that it can be in the 40 years that I have remaining? What actions, what values, what things should I pursue today to make my life the best that it can be over the next 5, 10, 15? That's hard, particularly for somebody young. It's hard, but that's what it means to take your self-interest seriously. And if we teach, and this is the whole thing, we need to teach it from when they're this big. We need to tell our kids, stop sharing and start thinking. Start thinking about what is really good for you. What's going to help you over the long run? And if we can teach kids to think, then they don't just act on whim, which is what, all these people who took out mortgages. It was just whim. They weren't thinking. They weren't saying, oh, interest rates always go up. Can I afford it when interest rates will go up one day? Real estate prices sometimes go down. Can I afford it if interest rates ever go down? If real estate prices go down, what happens if I lose my job? That's hard thinking, but that's the skills we need to teach our kids. We need to teach our college students, and they're not taught that. I mean, the whole American educational system is built around emoting, emotion. This is John Dewey's theory of education, which we as a culture have embraced. John Dewey believed that education was about socialization and emotional freedom. So you get a bunch of 8-year-olds around the classroom, right? And it's in social sciences class, which is not a, even a topic should be taught to 8-year-olds. And they sit around the thing, and they're asked, what do you think about Obamacare? Who cares what an 8-year-old thinks about Obamacare? They're not there to think about Obamacare, because all they can do is emote about it, and they can, you know, tell you what they're... They're there to study. They're there to learn. They're there to use their minds to learn stuff. And then later on, they can think for themselves. But that's not what we do. We sit around chatting. We sit around talking. We sit around, what are your emotions? What do you feel about Obamacare? That's the real question they ask them, right? What do you feel about the planet warming? What do you feel about those penguins dying? This is, my kids used to get this. What do you feel about the penguins dying because of global warming? So you double whammy there, right? Feeling and global warming, and you screwed them up completely. And they feel guilty. Then they come home and say, Daddy, you're driving a car and you're killing the penguins. I mean, they do. I'm not making this up. This is real stuff. I had to go to the school and say, if you're going to teach global warming, then you have to teach the opposite. You're discriminating against the point of view that says the globe is not warming, and there are scientists who say the opposite, and you have to teach both sides. So they stopped teaching it completely, because they wouldn't teach the other sides. They just stopped teaching it. But that's great. That's a victory. So if people think, if we connect thinking with self-interest, we win. And if we don't, we lose, because the other side is going to win on the emotional. I mean, emotions are self-destructive, and we're just going to destroy ourselves if we follow our emotions. Emotions lead us to just take the pile of money. Instead of thinking, how can I be creative and productive and efficient so that I can get the earn the pile of money, right? That's what you want. You want to earn it.
So I want to answer to this gentleman here that was asking the question about Judaism. And I want to say that Judaism is all about free market, because it says that you cannot give donation or from your income more than 10%. It means even a person that wants to give more than 10% is limited. And what is the reason? The reason is because we want to force the people to care for themselves. Nobody will wait for somebody to give. All this money, it's not even logically, not even fair. Judaism is all about free market and all about free thinking. And what you mentioned that about the religious thing, I'm not a religious person, but I learned a lot about religiosity. The Jews are all about freedom of choice. All Judaism is based on freedom of choice. No socialism, no capitalism. It's all about the freedom of choice, what's good for you. But on the other hand, it's written in the Bible that there will never be, that always be poor people in the nation. Always. God will never eliminate them for one reason. Because by the time, at the same time that you are a capitalist and you make money, you should never forget that there are poor people and it's your responsibility. Not the government's responsibility, but your responsibility.
See, I don't think it's my responsibility. And I don't think it should be your responsibility.
If your neighbor is hungry, whose responsibility is it?
If my neighbor's hungry, it depends. Do I like my neighbor?
It does make a difference. It's the balance of the Bible.
See, but that's not morality in my view. If my neighbor's a jerk, if my neighbor's a bad person, helping him is evil.
I'm not talking about a bad person.
My point is it's conditional. My help is conditional on the value that you present. And if you don't have value because you're a bad person, I'm not going to help you. So, and the point is, the standard is me, not my neighbor. The fact that my neighbor's starving is not place an obligation on me. What, I become a slave because he's starving?
You don't have to be a slave.
What if my neighbor is starving and my kid has a disease and I have to spend all my money on my kid?
So you're not obligated to help him.
I'm not obligated to help him. That's all I wanted you to say. Fine. It's not my moral obligation to help him. I could choose to help him, and I think good people would choose to help him.
And Judaism is freedom of choice. There's nobody forces anybody, but there's always a place to help each other.
I'll send you to some places in Brooklyn and in... where there's no freedom of choice, where Jews are dictatorial over one another, where they follow the Bible like dogma. There's nothing. Judaism is a religious, it's a religion that's interpreted in 1,000 different ways. There's some very good interpretations of Judaism, and there's some awful interpretations of Judaism. There's everything in Judaism. And the way the Bible is written, this is the genius of whoever wrote the Bible. The way the Bible is written is you can find whatever you want in it. You want to find capitalism in the Bible? It's there. You want to find socialism in the Bible? It's there. You want to find fascism in the Bible? It's there. Everything's there. No, it's a mushy document that allows the rabbis to argue about everything and to choose what they want. And that just proves that a mortal person wrote it. I'm sorry if I'm offending anybody's religiosity.
Is your assertion then that Judaism is, anti-Semitism arises from economic success versus the Judaism as a religious principle?
See, I think that it's, I mean, I think there are multiple causes for anti-Semitism. I started off by saying this is, I'm just focusing on one cause. There are multiple causes, but I do think that a central cause of anti-Semitism is economic success, but not just economic success, the means by which Jews became economically successful. They become economically successful by making money off of loans they gave to Christians. And that offended the Christians, and that really upset them. And God said that that way of becoming wealthy was a mortal sin, seventh rung of heaven. So it's the mechanism by which they became successful. But yes, success in and of itself is enough for the hatred. But Jews weren't always successful, and they were hated even when they were not, because they were still lending money. I mean, I don't know if you know the massacre of York in England in 12-something, right? Why was there a massacre? They killed all the Jews in York. Hundreds of Jews were killed in York. Why were they killed? Because the local prince, right, owed the Jews a lot of money. He had lent them a lot of money. And the easiest way to get rid of that is to stir up anti-Semitic feelings. And how do you stir them up? Oh, they killed Jesus. Da, da, da. You use religious excuses to stir them up. They drink blood of babies. But that wasn't the motivation. Motivation was to wipe out his debts. And not only did they kill, it was interesting because when they killed all the Jews, the first thing they did is burnt their book, you know, the debt, the accounting. Right? They didn't want any. And then ultimately, again, I don't know how many of you know, but for hundreds of years, Jews weren't allowed in England. England banned Jews until way after Elizabeth I. There were no Jews in England. Yeah. Well, they killed all the Jews, whether they burnt them. Yeah. Yep. Go ahead.
One thing I've noticed as I look at the various professions that are sort of more or less hated is the ones that the public can see in a more tangible way, say actors or sports figures or Steve Jobs, they can see exactly what they did to earn their money, and people seem to like them a lot better. The more abstract and intangible the means of earning your money is, the more hated people are. And of course, financial instruments and things like that are the most abstract and the hardest to see.
No, it's absolutely right. So this is an example I give. We've all played basketball. We've all like bounced the ball and shot it at a basket, and we all know how pathetic we are. We're terrible at it, right? And when we see a Michael Jordan play, we can say, wow, I can't do that. I couldn't do that if I practiced every day of my life. I couldn't. This guy is amazing, and it's entertaining. But you have personal experience that relates to some aspect. We've all tried to swim, but you see a Michael Phelps do it, and you go, wow, that's amazing. But it's not as entertaining, so he doesn't make as much money. But a Michael Jordan makes. And so we don't resent it because we have some experience in saying, wow, that's incredible. We've all kind of, we know what acting, how hard acting is. And so we don't resent them. But being a CEO, what do? A CEO, they shuffle paper, they boss people around. That's easy. Anybody could do that, right? And a financier, all they do is lend money and they charge interest. I mean, that's easy. They're paper shufflers. They do nothing. And what's the productive role of finance? Again, a complex topic, an abstract topic. So yes, the further away a profession is from people's experience, direct experience and direct understanding, the more resentful people are of it. So, you know, a CEO of a furniture company is going to be more respected than the CEO of a bank, because furniture I use. I can see the benefit. Banks, you know, that's abstract. That's hard to understand what they do. I can't hide behind my product. Yeah.
I was wondering, are you familiar with Dennis Prager's book, Why the Jews? He makes the case, and on the surface it might seem to contradict, but I actually think it speaks to a little bit of this point and a lot of what you're saying. Dennis Prager sort of traces the history of anti-Semitism, and to capitalist Jews were seen as communists, to communist Jews were seen as capitalists, and there's no question that Jews have been very involved in communism and socialism, this kind of thing. His basic, I guess, he says, in his point of view, is that fundamentally the reason anti-Semitism started were Jews were the people who introduced the concept of ethical monotheism. And while I don't necessarily agree with the way he says it, but I do think it has something to do with conceptual thinking, objective morality, whether at the time. That's what he basically, because if you look to, it even predates Jews' involvement in money lending. The Greeks saw the Jews as this people who made a claim. I don't know.
I mean, maybe I'm just not familiar with this, but I don't know of evidence to suggest that the Greeks and Romans were particularly anti-Semitic. I mean, they hated everybody. I don't think they hated the Jews in particular, right? They conquered people, and they forced them to worship their gods or whatever.
Well, but the Jews would.
Yeah, okay. So they were, yeah, well, you could argue who was right on that one. But you know, Greeks are pretty good. I don't think they particularly hated the Jews. I mean, there were a lot of people who didn't, and maybe they argued with, you know, but the roots of I don't think anti-Semitism as a concept exists pre-Christianity. The Christians are the ultimate anti-Semites, and then the Muslims come along, and they're not as bad as the Christians, although they're pretty bad. But they're nowhere near as bad as the Christians until the 20th century. But in pre-20th century, the Muslims treated Jews not well, but better than the Christians did. So to me, it's primarily a concept that derived through Christianity. I mean, the Jews were the ones who rejected Jesus as the Messiah.
Right, they viewed themselves as substituting for the chosen people.
Yeah, and the Jews were arrogant. They dared turn their back on Jesus, and they dared, you know, remain a chosen people after the Messiah had revealed himself. And the Messiah was Jewish, right? So Jesus was Jew. So that, I think, starts it off. That's the beginning of the conflict, right? But from the beginning, notice that Jesus is against money, right? I mean, who does he kick out of the temple? What's the big deal? He kicks the money changers out of the temple. I mean, Jesus in a very, very deep, substantial way is anti-capitalist, anti-prosperity, anti this idea of self-improvement.
So could you speak to the second point about the Jews' involvement in also anti-capitalist movements? You think it's just a secularized...
But first of all, that's a modern phenomenon, right? I mean, there was no capitalism until the 19th century. So it only happens in the 19th century. But yeah, I mean, first of all, Jews lead every single intellectual movement on the planet, right? At least in the West, right? Everything, right? From the communists to the Holocaust deniers is run by Jews, right? Noam Chomsky is a Jew, right? The horrific anti-Israel, anti-Semitic Noam Chomsky. To neoconservatism, to objectivism. Ayn Rand was a Jew. Leonard Peikoff was a Jew. I'm Jew. I mean, in a sense of where we come from, culturally, we're all Jews. So Jews lead almost every intellectual movement out there. And I think the reason is it's because the emphasis Judaism as a culture has always played on the role of the mind, on the intellectual features. Now, why are they so leftist? I mean, because in my view, they have been capitalist. They have been focused on making money, on being successful, on being prosperous. And that clashes with their moral code. And Jews, because they're more intellectual, take their moral code more seriously. So they feel more guilty than anybody else. Because this is a real question. Why is there such a thing as Jewish guilt? I mean, what are we going to be guilty about?
Because you have a mother.
But why does she make us feel that way? I often use I believe that guilt is one of the great mechanisms by which to manipulate people, right? And all you have to do is ask any Jewish or Catholic mother, and they'll tell you. It's a way to control people, right? But But where does Jewish guilt come from? It comes from this conflict of having an explicit morality, taking it more seriously than I think many others do, and living a life that's inconsistent with that morality. And that is a clash. There are also other reasons. One could theorize about Jewish guilt, but for another time. Yeah.
I'm not Jewish, but I received a grant to study J.P. Morgan and Francis Drexel and some of the early American bankers who were not Jewish,
yeah,
who really provided the capital for the subsequent,
yeah,
but the two prominent ones, and also there were two in the founding of our country who were not Jewish, of,
yeah,
course. Bishop John Carroll, his brother Charles, they were the funders of the American Revolution. I don't know how they made their money, but they were worth well over $10 million.
And what do we call these people today? Jewish or not Jewish, what do we call them? Robber barons.
Not the
original, because they funded something good called the but the J.P. Morgans, the Drexels.
The Morgans and the Drexels
were robber barons. Oh, J.P. Morgan's considered a robber baron? Everywhere I go. Everywhere I go.
Francis Drexel and the Carrolls, I know a lot about, especially the Drexels,
yeah,
and the Carrolls.
Yeah.
They were Catholic, both.
But no, I'm not saying they're Jewish.
Francis Drexel built the bank, but what he did was he knew if he could build the railroad across the country, then he could help build the country. And he built missions for the Native Americans. His daughter funded the African American schools in the United,
yeah,
States. Now that was charity, but he built it. And he was German. And I'm from a small town that was founded in the 1600s, and the bankers were German families.
Oh no,
they
I'm
were not. And they were...
Nothing I said...
Trust me.
Sure, I know they were. Nothing I said should suggest that all the bankers were Jewish. They clearly weren't. The Medicis. The Medicis were bankers, right? I mean...
They may have been from a Persian Jewish family.
Yeah, but they weren't Jews. At the time, they weren't Jews. But notice that the Medicis claimed they never charge interest. They did what Islamic bankers do today. They give you dividends, they give you this, but they don't call it interest. I mean, the Lombards were other Italian bankers who were not Jews. Many of the bankers in Europe were not Jews. And they were also hated, right? It wasn't reflected in anti-Semitism, a different form of hatred, but they were hated. American bankers of the 19th century are resented and hated today. And today when you have Occupy Wall Street, yes, there's an aspect of Occupy Wall Street that is anti-Semitic. If you went to some of the demonstrations, as I did, There were anti-Semitic signs in a number of them. But what motivated Occupy Wall Street is hatred of wealth. It's hatred of the rich. It's hatred of success. It wasn't cronyism, right? They didn't mind. They hated the fact that government bailed out the bankers, but they didn't mind that government bailed out Detroit. That was okay. The auto companies, that was fine. So it wasn't cronyism they objected to, just some cronyism, right? Selective cronyism.
Here's an easy one. Please comment on Wolf of Wall Street.
I haven't seen it. I don't intend to see it. The movie Wolf of Wall Street. But, this is a long line of movies that goes way back. Probably one of your favorite movies is It's a Wonderful Life, which I think is one of the most anti-American movies ever made, right? Because think about what it's about. It's about a successful banker who's obviously nasty, horrible, a crook, and a bad guy. He's horribly portrayed, right? That's a successful one. That's the one who's actually making money. Versus the not successful one, actually the one who won't default on anybody because he feels sorry for them, so he won't call back the loans, right? And his uncle loses the money, and the bank is now in default because they're incompetent. So it's a completely incompetent bank, and he's the hero. It's exact reverse of what it should be. And then instead of going to Paris, which was his dream, if you remember, Jimmy Stewart wanted to go to Paris. He wanted to live this fantastic life. He sacrifices his real deep-held desires, and he goes back to his town and leaves a mediocre, unmeaningful life. But he has a lot of friends, so it's okay. Well, okay, you had to throw that in there. But it's such, and Frank Capra was very anti-capitalist. I mean, Frank Capra, who made the movie, is very anti-capitalist. And you know, this is a movie that is trying to undercut capitalism, trying to undercut self-interest, trying to undercut the principles of America. It's a principally anti-American movie. And every Christmas we watch it, like it's considered the American movie. So then if you take that and you take Wall Street in the 1980s, Oliver Stone, which is a movie used to use in class because it is, if you want to see a movie brilliantly made, I think it's a great movie aesthetically, but it's pure Marxism. I mean, the lines in there he just takes out of Marx. And Wolf of Wall Street is just, you know, it's one continuum of portraying finance as this despicable activity, this horrific thing. And you see that throughout. You see that throughout Hollywood. You see that throughout the left. And it's not just, I used to give an assignment to my students. I used to teach a class in finance and ethics. And all the other professors would go, but that's a contradiction in terms. You can't teach that. I used to give this assignment to students. I want you to go out there and find a book or a movie that portrays a successful financier as the good guy. And they couldn't. And I'd say, okay, well, I'll make it a little easier for you. I want you to go out there and find a book or a movie that portrays a successful businessman as a hero.
Horatio Alger.
What's that?
Horatio Alger.
You have to go back to the 19th century. You have to go back to Horatio Alger. Now, there are exceptions, like Batman, right? Iron Man, although, you know, he's a little dude. You have to be a superhero, right? Or, I mean, a movie here or there that you could find that actually is. But you know who commits most of the murders on television?
Businessmen.
Over 50% of all murders committed on television shows are committed by businessmen. I mean, there's a group in the Midwest that does these statistics every few years. Who commits the fewest murders on television?
Community organizers.
I don't know if that's a category.
People
who work for the media commit the fewest. And lawyers don't commit. Lawyers are heroes on television, right? Lawyers, even though as a culture, we have a low opinion of lawyers, or we think we have a low opinion. On television, they're like the heroes because they're defending the little man. But you've never seen a show portraying businessmen as heroic as doing any. But business is heroic. Again, we didn't build America from 1776 to 1914 into this amazing industrial powerhouse because of lawyers. The heroes who built America are businessmen, right? But there's not a single television show. I mean, when we do a show on businessmen, it's called Dallas. And the scumbags, the awful, horrible human beings, right? There's never a portrayal of a positive. But this is all connected. These are all linked. This is all a result of the morality that we hold, and that we hold businessmen as self-interested and therefore evil by definition. Can we make this?
This is the Latin.
There's always exceptions. Yeah.
In Queer as Folk, the smartest guy in the
Queer
show
as Folk
is also a highly successful businessman, but that was okay because he was gay.
Yeah, I mean, but who can take seriously a show called Queer as Folk?
This is the last question.
Last question.
And then you'll sign books.
I'll sign some books, yeah.
I actually disagree with you about the anti-Semitism in Islam. I mean, it started with Muhammad himself.
I didn't say they weren't anti-Semitic. I just said the Christians were worse.
Dr. Andrew Boston documents extensively all the programs and everything else. But I think the thing is it goes back to what you're talking about with this leftist view of things. I think we've been so ingrained. I think it's been, you know, that stuff is put back because it's you know, that Islam is not a threat to them. They think it's, you know, Islam is...
Look, you're not going to find... You're not going to find anybody who thinks these Islamists are a bigger threat than I am. But history is history. And history is history. There's nothing like Hitler in the Muslim world. The Ottomans, often the people surrounding the successful Ottomans were Jews. The Jews in Palestine under the Ottoman Empire were treated okay. They weren't slaughtered en masse. There were pogroms here and there, but nothing on the scale of what happened in England during the 13th century, what happened in Germany time and time again during the period. I mean, the horrific nature of European anti-Semitism, and we're all European, so we want to forget that.
You're
But it's just not true. Now, I'm not justifying Islam. I mean, clearly Muhammad thought the Jews were bad guys, were evil by nature. He cut off their heads and he did horrible things to them. And then they were second-class citizens like the Christian. But it's not on the... I mean, everything I know about history, it's just not on the same scale. And this is not to justify Islam. It's not to be apologist for Islam or anything like that. Again, you won't find a bigger defender of the West versus them than I am. But it's just let's the more objective we are about what the history actually says, the easier it is to fight our enemies. And this is why I don't care about whether you call it about this whole question of are they Palestinians or not. It's not relevant to the discussion. None of this stuff is relevant to the discussion. They're the enemy. Let's categorize how they're the enemy and let's deal with them. And I could deal with them. Thank you all.
Thank you.